This is Walt Wedeen, and we've been talking about food for the future, the balance between science and nature this week. And this is the session when we'll be talking a little bit about science-based agriculture and sustainable agriculture as we move into the future. Okay, what we were doing before during the week was we talked about this balance between science and nature. In other words, just how is the production of agricultural products, the food, going to balance out with nature so that we don't foul up the environment? And agriculture has been already accused of using too much fertilizer and pesticides and so those types of things. And so what we want to do is talk about that. And if you have any comments, questions, as we go through this, be sure to sound off, because if I have any insight that I can share with you, I'll be glad to do that. If it's something that I don't know anything about, I'll tell you that. Okay, now what we did when we went through the week, we sort of took this in five stages. Actually, we skipped the one on Wednesday, so today what I'm going to do is take the science-based agriculture and then the last one and kind of blend them together. But first, what we did during the week was to look backward so that we could kind of move forward, and that the Golden Age was a time before agriculture evolved. And that was from about 10,000 BCE, before the Common Era, up to 3,000 BCE is when agriculture came onto the scene, when the plants were domesticated, when many of the animals were domesticated. Before that, it was hunters and gatherers. And this has been referred to as the Golden Age. And somebody has explained how somebody said that was an affluent society before agriculture came on. And somebody said, what do you mean affluent? He said, well, affluency can be defined if you have low expectations. If you don't expect as much, it's easier to satisfy these expectations. And then one other comment that I commented on earlier in the week was that somebody had written that agriculture was the biggest mistake almost in the history of humankind. Because if we visualize the period of time that extended from when mankind or humankind first started, way back earliest after the glaciations or the earliest formations of anything, up to the present, hunters and gatherers had been around for maybe 97% of the time to the present. And we've in the agricultural period, in the time of Christ, 10,000 years before that, up till now, represents only about 3% of the total time. So you see, if you put it in a sweep of time like this, it's almost unbelievable how that can be. Now,
it kind of coincides with industrialization. Then. You know, with the industrialization in the early 1800s.
Right.
You know, roughly.
Right. Well, that's the latter end of it, actually. I mean, that's right, and that is a result. That's what I want to talk about a little bit right today, is this science, how it affected agriculture. One more point I want to make, though, before we move up real fast, and that is that one of the reasons I'm interested is, as an agronomist, and why I like to share this, is that the basic processes by which the energy of the sun works with carbon dioxide and water and photosynthesis, the process in the leaves, to make all this green material, had to be the same process that was going on when hunters and gatherers were here. So we're still dealing with the same process, just that we maybe know a little more about it now from science. We still don't know it all by any means. It just becomes more and more mysterious the more you know about it. The second one was nitrogen fixation. It's the process by which nitrogen from the air is fixed into the plant material to form proteins, and it occurs in legumes like little white clover out in the lawn, or elder bushes that out in the, along the rivers. And on the mine tailings, I was out with a group on Monday. We saw that elder bushes are beginning to grow. So they're going to take nitrogen from the air, fix it into the plant material. Those leaves will maybe fall onto the mine tailings and build up the nitrogen content, and then maybe something else can grow. So nature will gradually do these things. And I think that's the approach now of the Forest Service. I was lucky enough to be along on a tour Monday when they explained this to a group of Russians that were here. And I came away with the conclusion that the plan is to do this, to let these mine tailings get covered over eventually with the most natural things that they can find that fit this area. And one of the questions that the U.S. Forest Service man had to the Russians, just as they left on Monday after they'd seen it all, these were all Russian foresters, he said, you think we will get this all sealed over with vegetation like the rest of it? Do you think we can do it? And if so, how long? And because he'd already told me that, you know, 100 years would maybe make it look real green all over. And one of the Russians said, 40 years. 40 years, you're going to just, he said, it's going to look fine, look pretty good. And 100 years, no question about it. And so that's, you know, that's really something when you think about it, isn't it? And I was just up to the Holden Mine. You see, here they were in there, it's 100 years ago now since they first started snooping around there. They thought they saw copper outcroppings up on the hill, and they got really excited about it. The surveyors came up through here. There were two railroads came up through here looking at this, and then they saw this one outcropping that looked like a copper ore outcropping, as I understand it. And then they started getting on this, and Holden got all fired up about it, and pretty soon he staked a claim, and then he set up his mine, and then he started mining, and it was touch and go. And then this Howe Sound Mining Company came in here and ran it from 37, 38 till 58, you know, and then it became non-economic, and they moved out, and so on. So it's just the whole process by which nature heals over these things is interesting. Now, the other process that I put in here is the cellulose digestion by ruminants. Those of us in the room here, we cannot go out and eat the grass here, and we wouldn't get along too well just eating grass. But the deer that are running around here, they, you know, they'll eat grass and leaves and thrive. Okay, so that's the difference. They can digest cellulose. And one of the most fun things within the last few weeks was to be to the Minnesota State Fair with grandchildren and a couple of them, and walking through the barns, and they had these prized dairy cows. And I guess I told about this one a couple of days. Walking through there, and there was one of these big prize Holsteins just reclining, you know, just and all nicely groomed. And I said that, I want you to come over here, watch. I want these cows. You think that cow is chewing gum? And sure enough, the cow is chewing gum. And I said, let's watch that. You think it's chewing gum? Oh, I don't think so. Are you sure? I said, what do you think it's chewing? Well, anyhow, so we kept on, and sure enough, there was a brief stop when the cow swallowed this cud, you know, that it chewed. Just brief stop, you know, if it can't be over about 5 seconds, and starts in again. You know, in other words, it puts that, it eats that grass, goes down into the rumen, and the bacteria and the protozoa and kicking around there, and then when the cow has time, it brings it back up and chews it again and puts it back down into another stomach. So, you know, I mean, that is a process that's been going on for a long, long time, taking these primary things that have been fixed by photosynthesis, the leaves and the cellulose, and putting it through another stage so that if we prefer to eat venison or prefer to eat or get milk from the cows, that this is the process of the whole cycling of the agriculture. Now, as I said before, and what I talked about earlier in the week, plus take a look at it on a world basis, was this early agriculture. What are some of the crops that drive the whole thing? And what we want to do then is talk today then about this science-based agriculture. How we got into that after you went through a stage which maybe lasted for, let's say, if we can say agriculture started in 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 BC, when there was a purposeful culturing of crops that you could, they could have been domesticated wheat, it could have been wild wheat was maybe still wild, some but some was domesticated, but you harvested this wheat, the kernels, and you stored it because you knew there would be a dry period. And then they learned to bake. We talked about that. The learning to bake bread was something that the Greeks were great at, and they taught the Romans. It said that the Romans had hired a lot, or they just made the Greek bakers made slaves out of them. So you had a lot of bakeries in Rome, but they were maybe it was all being done by the Greeks. And they found out that if you made bread out of barley, it didn't make very good bread. But then when they got a hold of wheat made a better bread because there's gluten in there. There's a protein that is sort of an elastic thing. When it's the bread will, it can rise and it doesn't. So you can get the bread so it's not just all flat down. Okay, so that's the grains evolved and they were transferred to different parts of the world. This, and alfalfa that I work a lot with was as a legume that's fed to the horses and cows, and it's a very high quality feed. That's a legume, and the Romans were really keen on alfalfa. It came out of Persia. It, as far as the records say, it was maybe 4,000 BCE when they first knew that alfalfa was around. And then the Romans used it because they had a lot of horses, and they fed this to alfalfa. And then for a long time, up till maybe 20, 30 years ago, they said, don't feed alfalfa to horses. You know, that wasn't a good deal. Back when we had a lot of horses, don't feed alfalfa to horses because that wasn't, feed them grass hay. But now the thinking has changed. So the show horses that you see down in Kentucky and places like that, they look for high quality alfalfa hay. So here's a crop that's been here for a long, long time, spread all over the world. And as I pointed out the other day when I was in Albania this summer, just across from Italy, lo and behold, there's alfalfa, a lot of it. And so that was what I was supposed to figure out, what we could do to get better feed for their dairy cows. And I right away I thought, well, let's key on the alfalfa because they've got it, they know what it's like. And over time, maybe in 5 years, they can have much better seed, they can have clean seed, they can do a better job of seeding it, of harvesting it, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what I concentrated on then. So these crops that were there, they were spread around. But agriculture as such was sort of a subsistence-based operation for many, many years. And the science-based agriculture really only came on in about 200-300 years ago. Now that's what the Industrial Revolution. And some of that originated in the centers of learning, and I'll just touch on a few of those cases. For example, in Germany, Justus von Liebig, I don't know if you remember from your science classes, he was sort of the father of chemistry. And I thought I could write on the board, but the thing is over there. What I was going to do for you was make a diagram. He said that when you have a plant growing, we know that the plant needs certain things. And it's like a barrel, the staves of a barrel. And I remember this concept that if you have staves in the barrel and you want to fill the barrel up with something, that the most you can fill into the barrel is at the lowest stave, not the highest stave, because when you get up to where the lowest stave is, the water's going to run out. So he likened those to the various elements. The plant needs nitrogen, the plant needs phosphorus, the plant needs potassium, the plant needs all of these, and now we know they know. So he said it was like plant growth was governed by the law of the minimum. So he had this barrel, and it didn't matter how much potassium he had, how much phosphorus. If nitrogen was limiting, the plant could only grow as long as it had plenty of nitrogen. It didn't matter how much phosphorus and potassium it had. So that was one of the early science-based agricultural things. So that in Germany, where this was occurring, they were able to say, well, this soil lacks some nitrogen, so we can let's put some more animal manure on this field, which is high in nitrogen, and then our plants will grow better. Or we know it needs some phosphorus, or we know it needs potassium, or we know it's acidic, and so we can correct the pH, and so that it's correct. So that's one of the illustration of early science, sort of a science-based agricultural.
How long ago was that?
That's about 1800s. Yeah. So here we are, 1900s, so just a couple hundred years ago. So that all happened. That spread through Germany and into England and places like that. And okay, then now let's go on and to just think and take another giant leap. If that's 200 years ago, and U.S. people settling the United States coming in and clearing away, let's say in New England, you clear away a bunch of trees and build a log cabin, and you kind of cut out some roots and trees and say, well, let's plant some potatoes, because we've got to have some potatoes to eat in the wintertime. So they plant the potatoes. And I remember that even in northern Wisconsin when I was a kid, because if we ever cleared away some more timber, my dad would say, we'll get a tremendous potato growth, but you don't get much tuber, you get a lot of top growth. In other words, you got a lot of nitrogen there in a native soil that's just been cleared away. So as you cleared away the eastern soils, and they were sort of cropped year after year, if they didn't have animal manures necessarily to put back, they sort of ran out of some of these nutrients. And the law of the minimum that Liebig had demonstrated back in Germany came into play. And farmers moved on. You know, as the land was moving west, they'd say, well, gee, you know, my yields of my crops are down from what they used to be. When I first broke this land, my gosh, I had big crops. Now they've run out. The soils have run out. The soils are worn out. So let's move on west. Let's get out there into Ohio. And then they went to Ohio. And then they said, well, let's get over in Illinois and out into Iowa. And you get onto Iowa, and they got out there on those high organic matter soils that were still wet. And they decided, well, let's drain those. Let's put in tiles. And the thing about it happened, and if you just jump real quickly from when Iowa was first cropped, it was wet and very, very rich soils. The level of organic matter in the soils of Iowa has gone down about half. And so one of the big questions as you move into a sustainable agriculture is you say, well, we can't let that continue to go down, because this was built up over a long, long period of time. And if we're going to be growing corn in Iowa 100 years from now or 200 years from now, we have to be sure that this isn't balanced. And so that's why you have, in Ames, Iowa, you have a big USDA Soil Science Institute. And it's called the National Tilth Laboratory. Well, what's soil tilth? T-I-L-T-H. Soil tilth, when you took a class in soils at the university, if you're asked that on a question, it was one of those questions that didn't have, you could say, well, it's a well-being of the soil, it's the balance of the organisms and the nutrients and the airspace, blah, 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 blah. You know, you could write a lot of that. They said, yeah, that's a good answer. But yeah, the thing is that the scientists nowadays, almost as if they say, yeah, that's okay in general, but what is soil tilth? Are we sure that the soils of Iowa are as healthy or as good as they were after we first drained them? And what are the benchmarks by which we can say that? Is it the soil organic matter, which nitrogen? Is it the acidity? What is this? So that's why there's a need for all this. So what we moved then was from this, with a science base of science, you moved into this agriculture that took us out of sort of a subsistence-based agriculture into a science-based agriculture, which after World War II in the 50s and 60s just sort of swept yields up higher and higher. And I remember, you know, visiting when I was at Iowa State University, a farmer south of Des Moines in Indianola, Iowa. And he was an interesting guy, a successful farmer. And I remember him just as clear as a bell telling me that he said, well, I have never, see, the university had to take a little bit of a conservative approach because you couldn't say, well, just put on all this fertilizer. And if you wouldn't say, use 2 pounds of this herbicide if 1 pound's going to do it. But this man telling me, he said, I'll tell you. And this was in the late 60s and 70s. He said, I've never gone broke yet taking what Iowa State recommends and doubling it. Okay? So that, how's that for an attitude? It's successful. In other words, if you'd say, all you need is 40 pounds of potassium on this to apply on this field, he'd say, well, if those guys up at Iowa State's 40, he said, geez, 80's better, so he puts on 80. So that was the 60s and the 70s, and the prices were right. And now I know, even though I'm retired from it, I know that the attitude is now that the farmer definitely has to ask the question. He can't have that attitude. You've got to say, I've got to look at what's economic. I want to yield. But on the other hand, I've got to be concerned about the environment. And so there are some big, not only academic arguments, but going on is, I've heard some people say, well, Iowa's over-fertilized. You know, it's plenty over-fertilized as a state. Well, that's a generalization, you know. But in other words, they had used a lot of fertilizer and see. So then, okay, now then, let's shift over. Let's bring up one other point here, because maybe some of you haven't had this background. In 1860, or 1840, 1845, right about the time of Civil War, when we had a lot of states, the people representing these agricultural states began to had enough savvy that so in Washington they began to say, well, we need help with these. We need help. We have a lot of questions out there as for our agriculture. So they began to toy with ideas, and out of that, and it didn't happen overnight. But in the early 1860s, signed by Abraham Lincoln, was the Land Grant College Act, what they call Land Grant College, and basically what this was. It's sort of like giving a chunk of land, telling the railroads, you know, we need a railroad onto the Puget Sound area, so you can have the land wherever the railroad goes, and that's how they got up looking up through Railroad Creek. You know, I mean, if they could figure it out, that I suppose they'd get the land. And so railroads still own some of this land because they got a tremendously good deal because they're willing to put the railroad in. The farmers said, well, we like to farm, but we need help. We need help. So they put up this land grant thing, and they said, each state will have a land grant college. We'll give you a chunk of land. We'll back it up. And then you can go ahead and you can get the teachers and professors, and you can begin to conduct research. So every state has it. For example, in Texas A&M. In Iowa, it's Iowa State at Ames. At the University of Minnesota, it happens to be at the University of Minnesota in St. Paul. In Wisconsin, it's the same. It's at Madison, University of Wisconsin-Madison. You know them all. At Michigan, it's at Michigan State in East Lansing. It's not at Ann Arbor, University of Michigan. And in Ames, or in Iowa, it's not at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. That's a medical school, dental school, and all this. The ag-based thing is at Ames. Okay, so there's been a structure going since 1860 to help this. That's called a land-grant college system in the countries.
Washington would be Washington State.
Yeah, Pullman. No, right.
Yeah.
Right. And then right over the border, Moscow, Idaho, you know, Iowa. So it's, and you know, sometimes when they get to fussing about things, they'll say, well, that's, what you know, aren't they the same climatically? Well, sure, in a lot of ways they are. So maybe in the future, if money gets tight, there'll be more combinations of efforts. Now, in 1890, there was another act that was passed that's very interesting from the standpoint of agriculture, and that was called the, what was it called? trying to think of it, but it really was to give money to the, well, they just call it the 1890 colleges. In the southern states of the United States, most of them had a black school, agricultural school for people of the black culture and of the, those of white. They were segregated. So this federal law said, okay, we're going to extend this to the 1890 colleges as well. Okay, so in, I don't know what Texas had. They must have had a Texas A&T or something. But in I was on a research review in Mississippi, and at Mississippi State was the one, and then the 1890 college was at Alcorn, A-L-C-O-R-N. So they were also, then they also could get some money from the federal government to do research. And then they've come together. They've come together over time, you know. But there's been, you know, the arguments and the everything else that's occurred in all those years. But the main point I'm getting at is that the U.S. government helped in this, the Department of Agriculture. And that allowed this movement for the science-based agriculture to be moved ahead. Now, let's jump up real fast up to the present day, almost. Out in the farming community, let's say we got John Q. Farmer out here. He says, boy, those guys over and gals over at Iowa State, they really know what to tell me. How to do my corn, what breed of cattle to raise, you know, what should I feed my pigs, and blah, blah, blah. And the women in the home ec college, home economics, they can tell me about, you know, what's needed in my home, the good nutrition, and all this and that. So that's been just slick as a whistle, 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s. On the outside, you've got some people that are saying, no, those they're basing too much on science. They're in cahoots with the fertilizer industry, okay? Because the fertilizer industry helps to support some of their experiments on fertilizers with corn that we really don't need all that. What I believe, because I've been reading about it, is that we shouldn't use these chemical fertilizers. We should be using organic fertilizers. We should have nature's way. It wasn't nature's way to take natural gas and make synthetic nitrogen, put it in the fertilizer, and grow corn. That wasn't nature's way. Nature's way was to have corn plants growing out here, and then maybe have a legume, and somehow or another the corn would grow. Okay, so you had the organic movement of gardening, or gardeners and so forth, that were over on one side of the fence, over here talking about organic gardeners. You had the university people who were talking about fertilizers, and they wouldn't talk to each other for a while. I remember myself, I was in charge of a seminar committee, and this must have been about mid-70s. And some of the original people that were getting to work on the organic, not organic farming, but sustainable ag, taking a look at this, the forward thinkers, we invited them in for a seminar, and some of the older professors, some of the older ones that had worked on the chemical fertilizers, you know, for most of their career, they wouldn't even come to the seminar. I remember that real well, but a lot of other people did. The students came, some of us came. I was, you know, because we were, and he gave a perfectly logical seminar, just telling us, you know, here's, and now then what's happened? What's happened in the, because this leads into this sustainable agriculture, which is sustainable agriculture, without going through a lot of discussion, is an agriculture, like I say, that is going to be balanced somehow between science and nature, and presumably it can be as sustainable as long as we can recognize. Okay? And if you live in a town, you're going to be able to say, those people that are farming today, they are not polluting the environment. If there's something contaminating our stream, we cannot point our finger at the people on the farm. You might say, oh, gee, it's people up here in the orchard. Or it's, no, it's up there on Railroad Creek. It's coming down from Holden. But they aren't going to automatically say, oh, the farmers are using too much fertilizer or pesticides. See? Because the farmers And agriculture is, if they have done wrong, they are really beginning to clean up the act. And if they don't, the EPA or somebody else is going to be having them clean it up pretty soon. Now, then that leads to this whole new concept of sustainable agriculture. So we had these chemical fertilizers, sort of science-based agriculture gone just in fast gear, organic over here, and never the twain shall meet. Now they've come together in the middle. And you've got every one of these land-grant colleges right now has maybe a sustainable agriculture institute in which people are looking at these questions. And they're trying to bring down what are these costs. In Iowa, for example, they have an organization called the Practical Farmers of Iowa. The Practical Farm, and it started 10 years ago. And it's gaining momentum all the time. It's these farmers come together and they talk about how practically they can farm, not how big the yields are. See? So there's a lot going on out there, and it's very, I'm really pleased about it. And let me just give you some other names then that you might hear about. It can be called alternative agriculture, sustainable agriculture. At one time it was called low input agriculture, but a lot of people didn't like that. They fussed over that definition because when you said low input, they said, what do you mean low input? They said, well, we mean, you know, you aren't going to put on too much fertilizer. And then the first thing I say, yeah, but I'm putting in a high input of intelligence. So let's not use that, because low input means that, you know, I mean, it's just a rinky-dink operation. So they've kind of gotten away from that. They're talking about an alternative agriculture or a sustainable agriculture. And I could read you the exact definition of what it is, but I think you can get the idea from what I tell you. And here's a journal, for example. American Journal of Alternative Agriculture. This is 1990, 5 years ago. This is volume 5. So it would have started in 1985. It's only 10 years old. A journal where you get papers written by the scientists that have to do with the practical farming, the sustainable agricultural movement.
So that actually, I guess I wasn't aware of that maturing that much.
Oh.
From the old way to this way. Refreshing to me.
Well, and I've likened it a lot to like something like General Motors, big cars, little cars. Mm-hmm. You know, there were a lot of people that wanted to drive, that drove Volkswagens for a long time because they couldn't buy a little teeny American car that was high mileage and gave them all the things they wanted. And General Motors kept pushing at you with the big ones. But then they finally got us little cars. And so, all the things we've gone through in that. And so now you can maybe buy little cars from many different places. And this huge agricultural industry isn't going to be turned around right away. What has happened? All I can say is that if theological, not theological, but some of the things about the church and what we teach, if some of the original thinking generates out of Holden, Holden Village, well, then I would say that some of the original thinking out of changes in agriculture are going to maybe generate out of groups of farmers, like the Practical Farmers of Iowa, or maybe within a university where people are saying, you know, we aren't going to continue on this way. And now let me just give you an example of this. I think we got time. And then I'd like to take questions because I can talk a long, long time, but I'd just soon have some of you ask questions. This is out of this journal here, American Journal of Alternative Agriculture. This is one that was really interesting to me. This is last year, because I'm interested in this country, and I know there's a few other, for example, the potential for Swedish farms, okay? The potential for Swedish farms to eliminate the use of artificial fertilizers. Okay? Now, this is a report of what they've done in Sweden, of about is there a potential to not use any fertilizers at all after a while? It's pretty interesting. It really is. And what you have, and I pulled up this view graph to show you, that this comes out of this article. So let's take a little look at that for a moment. Here's what they're saying. Here they got the word input and output. And they're talking about, let's see if we can get this thing to balance out. We don't want to have a lot more stuff coming in here that we can't account for. It's going to end up in the streams. So here we have sunlight, precipitation, rain, and then this biologically fixed nitrogen that I talked about that even hunters and gatherers had back in before agriculture. And they're talking in this case about nitrogen. And here they're saying, they've got some quantities in here. We won't talk about those right now. But they're saying these are all coming in here to produce this plant. And then this is going to move on into some system. And out of that, we're going to come out. So here we see the word crops are sold. And so if it's sold directly, it can go out here. And then they'll say, well, 60 pounds came into the system, but we only took 10 pounds out of it. Now, where are the other 50 pounds? Is that accumulating in the soil? Is that going to be a problem? See? If it's eaten by a dairy cow, still only 10 pounds goes out in the milk and the carcasses of the animal. There must be some left there. Okay, so, and then in the rotation for crop, diverse crop rotation with fodder grain, with a lay, that's like a hay field. It's an English word for alfalfa grass that you would feed to livestock. So they're talking about this a six-year rotation here, of 2 years of a meadow, and then growing a grain like wheat for baking, and then put a root crop in like they do over there, something like a fodder beet, where they grow the beets, and then those are fed the livestock. A fodder grain, 2 years, and this goes in the system. And they're saying in that system, where it goes through, I'm not sure just how exactly this follows, but maybe it's a loss of 25. But anyhow, they've diagrammed this whole thing out, and they explained it in their article. And then they have output. And then they show here that some of this nitrogen is going to be locked up in the soil humus to improve the soil tilth of the soil. And that's what they've got in this article, which I've read a time or two and looked at it. And that's not my purpose to discuss it. But it seems to make some sense to me. They're basically saying they have shown it can be done. So this is what the whole thing, you know, I mean, people are going to read this. Scientists are going to read it. They're going to read what the Swedes said that they've done. And they're going to say, well, gee whiz, let's see if we can maybe do that in southern Minnesota. Let's see if we can do that in Iowa State. Let's see if we can do it over in the Palouse area or something. And that's the way it's going to evolve. And so I'm really pretty hopeful. And plus the fact that in the farm bill, which is being discussed right now in Washington. So we had a farm bill that gave support to help for various parts of agricultural support, including, as I understand, food for homeless, and I think that comes within the USDA's budget, and that's a big one that'll be maybe discussed a lot. The research to agricultural colleges and universities will be in there. A lot of things will be in there. That's all being discussed in Washington right now, and they pass that every 5 years. We had a 1985 farm bill. We had a 1990 farm bill. We'll have what they call a 1995 farm bill, and in 1985. This sustainable ag business didn't get much money at all. 1990, they got more money to work with. And 1995, it's expected they're going to get even more. And that,
Congress?
Oh, yeah. I think they'll get at least what they have.
Well, I kind of got the impression that the farm, you know, we have so few votes nowadays for the farm to get a decent bill passed.
Yeah, but it's what drives the, what when the people that vote on the Ag Committee sit down and open the letters, you know, if they have a congressional aide counting up the number of letters they got, you think they're going to put them into the piles from the farmers and non-farmers?
No, I was just kind of wondering about it, because I've got that impression that they wouldn't have much influence, or I haven't had in years, as it did some years ago when there were more people actually living on the land. You know. I hope you're right.
Well, there may be people that are writing in being heard about agriculture, even if it isn't farmers, but people that want to buy vegetables and fruits that are organically grown.
Yeah. And as one person has said that you can look at it at this point in time, and this wasn't my thinking, but I'm working on a project where this man that I think is very wise has summarized. I was in charge of a workshop, and this man was asked to summarize it up. And so I've reread what he wrote, and he said that there were two trains of thought as to support for some of these type of things for the future. And what is the one way you can look at it? One would be supply-driven, and the other would be demand-driven. And I thought that was good. In other words, if you look at the supply-driven side, and you go to a farmer, or somebody, let's say a farmer, somebody in town that's selling John Deere equipment, they might be looking only at the supply-driven side. They say, well, you know, if you buy my tractor, you can produce a higher yield because I can sell you a better tractor, and that old clunker you got out there just doesn't get the fields done quick. So first thing you know, the guy's bought a tractor. And the farmer said, well, to pay for the tractor, I've got to get a higher yield. And maybe if I boost the fertilizer up, I can get it. So, you know, it's that kind of a demand or a supply-driven side. I'm going to supply more. I'm going to make enough so I can stay in business. Now, if you come from the demand side, it's all of us in this room as consumers, you know. We could say, if we all sat down and wrote to our congressperson or our senator and said, you know, hey, we're in favor of that you vote for more money for the farm bill, but only if it's for the sustainable ag part of the farm bill, period. See, and that's demand driven. And that's personally what I think is going to be happening. Now, I may be wrong, but I think even the companies, and I've been consulting for Senex Land Lakes, which is a cooperative, and I can see the thinking there because even a company operates has to operate with a bottom line, and there's greater accountability now in farming, in agriculture. There just has to be, because people, I think that. I think a grower of apples in the valley going on down towards Wenatchee, I think they're going to have to know what they put on as herbicide, when they put on it. They're going to have a record of it. And I think the same thing is going to be true in for an Iowa farmer or Minnesota farmer. They're going to have to know, when did you apply these fertilizers and how much? Because they're going to have to be accountable. They're going to have to be accountable there, because somebody, if something flares up in the food chain further down, they're going to say, well, they're going to start pointing fingers back up here. And the best defense is for the farmer to say, well, this is what I bought. I bought 16 ton of fertilizer. It was applied on such and such a date on this number of acres, and that's it. And this was recommended based on the soil test from Washington State University, based on the latest research, and that's it. It was... In fact, I put on less than they recommended. So that's where it is. It's going to be it'll be a precision type. Now, these people that want to farm practically, so to speak, a practical farmer of Iowa, or let's say somebody that says, I want to do it completely different. I'm just cold turkey. I'm not going to use any fertilizers. And I don't require a lot. Sort of like almost... You know, they say, I'm going to be affluent if I can just have a garden and raise my family and have a garden, and I'll keep some cows or whatever. I'll sell grapes in town. Fine. You know, that's fine. Why not? I can't see anything wrong with that. And the town will have its farmer's market, and you know, that's fine.
I got a couple things. One is the size of the farm. Is that going to be, you know, as it keeps getting bigger and bigger?
Yeah, I don't know.
Is that turning something back to I mean, the guy has to have more land because he's got the big machine.
Right.
Kind of built on itself.
I think the statistics, Iowa State used to, and I haven't seen it for a year or two, I think that the average size was still going up. Now, when you get into hog production, and for example, let's talk about production of pigs. There, it seems like it's getting the bigger units, no question about it. So this is a real concern to a lot of people. For example, Iowa used to have the most hogs produced of any of the states, Iowa or Illinois. Okay? That was back 25, 30 years ago. You could just go zipping down across Iowa and you know, you could just smell the hogs out there. Okay? Now, in the small farms. But that's gotten bigger. That is no question about it. And guess what? I think the number of hogs, the highest number of hogs being produced now is in North Carolina.
Hmm. Are they still doing it on a smaller scale?
No. They've gone to bigger.
They've gone to great big too.
Yeah. And so there you have it. And also in the chicken production and dairy. In dairy, the whole dairy, if let's say Wisconsin was the number one dairying state, you know, for years. And that has gradually shifted now so that, well, Texas has gotten quite a few dairy cows, and a lot of the dairy cows have gone to California. Okay?
Everybody knows a good deal.
Sure. And they've gotten bigger units. So now you ask me, will that stop? Gee, I don't know. You know, I mean, I just don't know. All I know is that in Wisconsin, they have, I was at a conference about a year and a half ago when they asked me to come and attend, and basically it had to do with grazing of dairy cows, going back to grazing. Okay, in the dairy industry, you know, years and years ago, they used to let the cattle go out and graze. Well, then they gradually so they put the dairy cows in, and it almost became like a milk factory. You just, you know, harvest the feed, bring them in there, and push that production up as high as you could. Well, they'd say, gee, down New Zealand they don't do it that way. And so the Wisconsin farmers, you know, they'd sponsor a trip of Wisconsin farmers, fly down New Zealand and see what they're doing in New Zealand, or go over to Holland or Denmark or wherever, and where they graze cattle. And then New Zealand farmers, you know, they're having a tough time, so they're jumping on their plane and they're running over to see how can these Wisconsin farmers get such high production out of their cows. Maybe it's because they feed them grain, a lot of grain. So the planes are crossing in midair, and they finally said, hey, why don't we just have a conference where we really talk about grazing of livestock? And so they had this 3-day conference in Wisconsin, and I sat through it. One of the jobs I had was, along with three other guys, just listen to everything. Just listen to everything at the end, get up and critique it. You know, what did they say? So they want somebody that knew something about crops, somebody that, you know, different areas. So it was interesting. I took a whole pad of notes. I mean, I really listened, and it was very interesting. And they covered everything from the breeds of the livestock, from the how do you house them, the labor situation, the prices. They went through everything. And lo and behold, you could conclude that Wisconsin could change the way they do the dairy industry. And it's not impossible for a cheese factory in Wisconsin to change. See, because they used to have an argument to say, well, gee whiz, you know, we've got to keep the milk coming, we got to keep the dairy products coming to the cheese factory every month because the cheese factory has to operate all year long to pay for itself. Down New Zealand, they'd say, why doesn't the cheese factory shut down at the same time that we have all of our cows non-lactating or not milking? Then the farmer gets a vacation. You got 60 cows, never gets a vacation in Wisconsin. Down New Zealand, they just do a little timing with the rebreeding of their cows and so forth, And they say, we'll get all these cows dry at the same time, so I'll take a vacation. And the cheese factory knows, well, X number of farmers aren't bringing me milk these 2 months, so I don't need as much help. So we won't make cheese.
Are they going to change?
They do it in New Zealand. Wisconsin said, the cheese expert said, this is interesting, cheese expert said, well, sure, he said, this business not changing is not impossible. In fact, it is changing. That we already, and then he gave the different kinds of cheeses in Wisconsin, it already shifted from, I don't know, good old American processed cheese to cheese that you put on pizzas, you know. In other words, these things are happening out there, and so it can change. But I, again, where does the change start? And all I'm saying is that I think that. The other thing that was very interesting is that, and you might enjoy this, that these New Zealand guys, and there were a couple of farmers, some from a dairy processing cooperative, university economist, and we went to visit two entirely different farms in Wisconsin. That was a year ago, last fall, in one day. One of them was this, that they had everything just synchronized perfectly. Like they had 125 cows. There was a man and his wife, and they had a hired man. They did it all. Got up at 4 o'clock in the morning. He had everything just neat and clean as a whistle when he came there. But apparently they worked around the clock. And I asked the question after, you know, the man got up at 4, the hired man started at 5, they milked the cows, 100 cows, da-da-da-da-da. They cleaned the barn, they swept it up, they had tractors going and everything. And you looked around, everything was fine. Cows never got out to pasture. They just, you know, they brought in all the silages and everything else. And then they began to ask questions. And various questions. And I asked the fellow, I said, do you get a vacation? And the fellow said, well, he said, I got off of chores last January 30th in the evening. I went to a short course about dairy over at the university. I think that was the third week in January. And in other words, he'd gone to the short course, and one of these New Zealand guys next to me, he said, geez, this is crazy. He said, this is crazy. And then in the afternoon, we went to another farm where the guy had just changed absolutely from all of this, and he said, we're just going to graze all these cattle. We're going to graze all these dairy cows. I figured it out, and we're going to put up a bunch of fences, and we're not going to go out there and haul all that feed in. We're just going to let these cattle go out and graze. And he said, it's working. He said, it's working. Well, a lot of people say, well, I don't know about it's working or not, you know, and, you know, it's only been 1 year and so on and so forth. And the upshot of it is, somebody said, well, guess what happens? The upshot of it is, if you look down New Zealand, young people are clamoring, young male and maybe female agricultural potential people are saying, I'd like to get on a dairy farm. What happens to a Minnesota or Wisconsin youth? I'll be darned if I'm in. And the father is saying, boy, don't get into this business. This is horrible, you know. So there you are. I don't know where it's going to come out.
Doesn't that synchronized lactating keep the bull busy at one time of the year and very slack the rest of the year?
No, they use artificial.
There's a town in New Zealand that is called, it's a farming community, Bulls. And they say we get our cows from bull. I get milk from bulls.
Was that very good?
Well, when the cows,
go ahead.
The cows get out to graze. They fertilize the land.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to spend that.
Is it healthy for an animal to stay in the barn all the time? Mm-hmm.
They just give some antibiotics.
Force fed.
Well, you're all answering the questions. It's right. I mean, some of these, the natural, if you think about it, the natural way for a dairy cow that or a ruminant that produces milk is maybe to graze and get its own feed. But that's been changed so drastically ever since science-based agriculture started that's not the way it's done. Now, the question is, if it goes back, and what I the last 5 years that I was teaching at Iowa State, I was adding a lot more on grazing. And even, and that'll go back now about a period of 10 years, I didn't give much time at the end of a course, you know, quarter, and then I'd have the evaluation of the courses at the end. And invariably, they said, we want more on grazing. I guess it, maybe it's because this other stuff was a little dry and I'd get real fired up at the end or something. But they want more. And so I think that it would be just like young folk telling us back 15 years ago, gee, why do you drive that big old car? Why don't you drive something small? You don't need to use all that gasoline. You can drive a smaller car. So I think what the message is, it's coming. Now, a Frenchman wrote 2 or 3 books on grazing. Voisin, his name was, V-O-I-S-I-M. And those books are in the library, maybe every land-grant college. And I know now that those books are being pulled up and brought into the classes. And there's a lot of grazing clinics going on. And then under the free enterprise system of New Zealand, they had learned how to put little electric wires around fences, you know, that could be put up quickly and cheaply and were efficient. You don't have to put in big posts and 4 barbed wire fences, you know, 4 barbed wires. You can, if you do it correctly, you could do it. And so guess what? The New Zealand people have come in and are selling that stuff in the U.S. And
we had that in Denmark.
Do you?
40, 50 years ago.
Yeah, sure you did.
Yes.
Yeah. But maybe, right.
And summertime was out and wintertime was in.
Yeah, yeah. And so to get back to the question, that the grazing I was going to lead around to was one of the, I wrote some papers about this, but on a couple times I had a talk. One of them was to the Iowa, this is a huge organization, it's called the Iowa Fertilizer and Chemical Dealers Annual Convention in Des Moines. Okay, this is all the fertilizer people and all the everything coming in. How much should you put on a corn? You know, I mean, these are people that are moving a tremendous amount of fertilizer and chemicals to the Iowa farmers. So there's a tremendous number of people coming in there. Okay, they asked me to talk about forages and grasses and grazing. Is it going to amount to anything? So I prepared. What I did is I said, first thing we got to do is define grazing. And guess what? They really liked it because I went back in the dictionary, pulled up Webster's definition, and da 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 da. And finally, the definition I said we all work on, Voisin's definition from France was grazing is the, and I like this, it's a meeting of the cow and the grass. It's just when the cow comes and eats that grass, okay? And it's different. It's different than if you cut it. If we cut that plant, Voisin said, there's something about that when the cow bites that off, it's not as harmful to the leaves. There's a little bit of saliva, apparently, that goes onto the plant. There's this symbiosis. I mean, he makes it just really sound dramatic. And I suppose a person that's selling silos and choppers said, that's nonsense. Well, we don't know if it's nonsense or not. I mean, but this is, so there's interest in that, and we'll find out. And so I think if we can get the cows back out on the land, right, good, you know. But whether it's going to happen right away, we don't know. And I think a lot of people that are not, gee, if I was a banker or if I was a farmer, we'd come at a different viewpoint, wouldn't we?
Sure.
I mean, if we had this.
Well, I mean, the salesmen for all this chemical are certainly are. Working.
Yeah, but you know what they're going to be selling? There's still something going to be sold. And they know it. That as, you know, let's say a farmer is bigger. Let's say a farm is big. There's a big investment. Then you're going to make this. The farmer wants to have a vacation, and he wants to be able to go on a cruise ship, or you know, or whatever it is, like anybody else. I was talking. Okay. So, and he also has to be sure he doesn't put on too much fertilizer, blah 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 blah, all that stuff. So, this Senex Land O'Lakes cooperative that served him 30, 40, 50 years ago. You know, and sold him the things he needed, they're still interested in helping him or her. So what do they sell to him? They sell him the computer expertise. Every farmer doesn't have to keep his exact records. Mm.